One of America's most prolific, provocative, and persuasive writers on education, Frederick M. Hess has published over a dozen tomes on schooling. Today we talk with Rick about his magnum opus, published by Harvard University Press, The Same Thing Over and Over, How School Reformers Get Stuck in Yesterday's Ideas. In it, he provides the long view of education reform, detailing the history of the familiar institutions we take for granted today, and arguing for much more flexibility in our thinking and our educational delivery. Join us for today's edition of the Education Next Book Club. Rick, welcome to the show.
Hey, Mike. Thanks for having me on.
You know, we often do our Education Gadfly Show podcast, but this is a little different. This is to talk about this one piece of work, The Same Thing Over and Over. You know, people joke that you publish books more often than most people go on vacation, you know, several a year, it seems like, and yet this one holds a special place in your heart. What were you trying to do with this book that was different from your previous work? Why did the world need this one after everything else they've heard from Rick Hess?
You know, this is something I've been working on probably 5, 6, 7 years off and on. And like you mentioned in the lead-in, it was really an attempt to offer the long view. You know, so many of our reform conversations either start from the premise that nobody has thought of this before, or that it's simply a question of political willpower. And it strikes me that a lot of things that once made sense don't make sense anymore. Things like tenure and step in line pay scales doesn't mean they're terrible, horrible things, and doesn't mean the people who defend them are evil. It just means that they're not a good fit for the world that we live in today. And I think that often gets lost when people, you know, when people don't have a sense of how we got where we are. And then the other part of it is I often feel that, you know, the world of ed research and ed scholarship is, you know, unhelpfully divorced from the stuff we're actually talking about when we're trying to make decisions and organize schools. And I think that's ludicrous. I think, you know, there's a lot of stuff that we know about schooling, that we know about how education works, that doesn't necessarily speak to an evaluation of a reading program that we should be thinking and talking about. And I think kind of history and how decisions have been made over time is, you know, a really useful device for helping talk about how some of this research analysis speaks to practical decisions that folks are making every day in state houses and school districts.
And in the book, you don't just go back to the Progressive Era or Horace Mann. I mean, you go all the way back to the Greeks and Romans. I mean, what is the point of going that deep in history? What are you trying to do there?
So there's two things. You know, one is just like we often seem to think that the constructivist versus essentialist divide in schooling today, that we have to settle this. We forget that there's a historic dimension to this, that people have argued about this stuff 100 years ago. But more is the case, people have argued this about the very creation of the notion of schooling in the Western world. You know, I flag in the book that Plato himself came out on both sides of the question of how much whether constructivism is good or bad. In the Republic, he denounced it. But when designing his own school, he was a huge constructivist. So the notion that we have to run experimental field trials to figure out which side is right and which is wrong in these debates is, I think, mistaken. Is it's misguided that both of these mindsets can make points at certain times, certain places. The other thing, so that's one thing that I think this going all the way back does. And the other thing is that as you look back in time, you see that people have done things which are considered verboten today. So, you know, one of my favorite examples that you've heard me talk about is the Greek city-state of Teos, I believe it's pronounced. They paid their javelin teachers one-third of what they paid their music teachers, you know, more than two millennia ago. Differentiated pay is not some radical new concept. This is something the Greeks were doing, you know, 80-plus generations ago.
Right. So if we wanted to pay our phys ed teachers a third of what we pay our physics teachers, that might be the same analogy.
Exactly. People say, well, wait a minute. That's an attack on schooling. And I'm like, wait a minute. It's entirely consistent with what has been done at sometimes in some places. And I think the same is true when it comes to the role of religious schools, when it comes to a number of issues where people on one side of the debate seem to say that anything that they don't endorse is an attack on schools.
Now, let me challenge you on something right from the outset here, Rick. At the beginning of the book, you have a almost a throwaway line that you see in most school reform books, something like, you know, since 1970, we've made almost no progress in student achievement, yet, you know, there's been all these efforts. Why is that? But, you know, if you break the data down and you look at individual racial groups, or if you look at low-income students, you see that we've made tremendous progress for poor and minority kids, that there was huge progress in the age of desegregation for African-American kids, and that in the age of standards-based reform, we've seen more big progress for African-American, Latino kids, low-achieving kids, low-income kids. If you look at that, you could say that actually some of the things we're doing in the reforms are working. So what does that do to your whole... your whole argument in
the 17-year-old NAEP scores, Mike? You're feeling good about where these kids are when they're going out in the world?
Okay. All right. So that, I mean, that's your main, because you're right. We've seen big progress at fourth and eighth grade levels, especially fourth grade, and we don't see that same at the 12th grade.
And, you know, honestly, look, over any period, I think you can point to isolated successes. And, you know, it's, and some advocates might say moving reading and math achievement scores for some of these populations is more than an isolated success. Just like folks, you know, in the middle of the century would say, look, going from 10% of Americans finishing high school in 1900 to more than half finishing high school in the second half of the 20th century was a huge triumph. But look, we have massively increased the resources we devoted to this. We have massively increased the import we accord to schooling. And it strikes me in the scheme of things that, you know, sure, there is some, you know, you can certainly point to some evidence that some populations are doing better, at least during some of the K-8 years, even though those gains don't seem to hold on. Mm-hmm. But I don't think hardly anybody involved in the debate thinks that this represents really substantial improvement over where we were 30, 40 years ago.
Okay. All right. Well, let's get into the history, because I found that both fascinating and a lot of fun. You go back to our founders, and you talk about their thinking on education as a driver for social mobility. We take as a given almost, it's that we don't even talk about it. It's just assumed that many of us reformers say, well, the schooling is the way to help poor kids get out of poverty. What did the founders think of that?
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's funny, right? This represents just a seismic shift in how we've talked about this. The two founders who probably most thought about education were Thomas Jefferson, famously, you know, launched University of Virginia, and Benjamin Rush. And for both of them, the purpose of schooling was actually to help maintain tranquil relations in a Republican society. Part of that was helping people learn their place, which meant that you didn't want too much too many disturbances between those who were going to live in the affluent life and those who were going to live. So Benjamin Rush spoke of needing to train citizens to be Republican machines who would, you know, accept their role in democratic order. Mm-hmm. And more fundamentally, what Thomas Jefferson talked about was schools as a place really to sift, you know, the pebbles and find the nuggets of gold. So the idea was not that we were going to, what the founders did not imagine schools were going to be able to do was lift all children up. The purpose of an expansive system of public schooling was to try to find those nuggets of talent that would otherwise go unharvested and pull them away from all the rubble that was their friends, and then leave their friends there so they could go on and do all the kind of routine rote work. And, that was how the founders thought and talked about it. That was what the system of schooling that's what they thought they needed to design a system of schooling to do.
So Thomas Jefferson, it was sort of social mobility for very few.
For very few. Thomas Jefferson's, you know, famous plan for education in Virginia, which was then the nation's largest state because it was still also West Virginia, envisioned 153 boys a year going on past the earliest elementary grades. And after 3 years, he wanted to sift it down to one child a year who would actually get a free secondary education. You know, if you're Katie Haycock, this is not what you have in mind. So it's not.
No, she probably would not have approved of some other things that Thomas Jefferson
exactly.
did, like own slaves.
Exactly. What I try to make real clear in the book is nowhere is this the point to say, aha, this is what education is supposed to be in America. But the point is that this was a system designed very explicitly to sift individual nuggets out of the rubble, to lift up a handful of kids who would be given a chance to engage in more learned activities.
Mm-hmm.
And look, that's not what we want to have happen today. That's not what we talk about today.
Mm-hmm.
So the notion that we should somehow allow the norms of two centuries ago to restrict the way we organize or deliver schooling today mm-hmm. would seem kind of self-evidently problematic.
All right. They were pro-creaming, sounds like.
They were. The schools only existed to cream.
Yeah. You go way back to the Greeks to talk about the conflict between academic and vocational education. And it's amazing that you have Plato and Socrates debating these same things that we still debate today.
Absolutely. You know, and it's funny. Andrew Colson did that book about, 10, 15 years ago, his market education book, where he talked about how choice has always proven superior throughout the history of the world. You know, and he had, I guess it was Sparta and... in Athens, if I recall right.
Yeah.
And talking about how Athens had a free market in sophists. And look, the Greeks, you know, over the course of centuries, went through almost all the debates that we think are so new and fresh today and that people get so excited about. And sure, you know, when you were, you know, in a Greek city-state, you had these questions of to what degree should education be about cultivating broad liberal arts skills and raising kids to be members of a democracy, and how much of it was teaching them practical ability as far as being, you know, as soldiers or being farmers. And, you know, frankly, Plato's Republic famously wrestles with this, where he divides the citizens into the three castes of society, the philosopher kings, the guardians, and then all the rest of us schmucks. And, you know, the rest of us schmucks mostly need to be drilled in how to do useful stuff. And the philosopher king is going to be tracked into an academic track where he is taught to think big thoughts and figure out how to rule us. You know, it's just, so again, the notion that somehow we have somehow stumbled into doing this wrong and that there's cut and dried solutions that we just need to stumble on is, I think, probably an unhelpful kind of, you know, rabbit to chase.
Right. In this particular example, it's these debates we have about college and career readiness. Is that the same thing? Should we be aiming for college for all? Not new debates.
Not in the least. And, you know, and people are like, well, look, obviously, if you're not for college for all, you're, you know, you don't care about marginalized kids. Or if you are for college for all, you are, you know, denying the value of practical work.
Or you're saying, I want to keep in place this caste system.
And the reality is, look, that, you know, at the least, we ought to recognize that these are millennia-old debates which lend themselves to no clean and simple answers. And we ought to be able to argue about and try to devise policies with some respect for people who might come down in a different place than we do.
We're talking with Rick Hess, the author of The Same Thing Over and Over, How School Reformers Get Stuck in Yesterday's Ideas. We'll be back after this short break.
For in-depth features, cutting-edge research, and up-to-the-minute commentary on education policy, check out educationnext.org. There you'll find blog entries, new articles published weekly, plus videos, podcasts, and more. That's educationnext.org.
We're back with Frederick M. Hess, otherwise known as Rick, talking about The Same Thing Over and Over. This book is not The Same Thing Over and Over, Rick. This is a lot of fresh material for you.
It's fun stuff.
Yeah, good. Well, let's keep talking about some of the history here. Talking about the common schoolers, the Horace Mann years. First of all, you mentioned something about what life was like when Horace Mann was pushing for the common school. How long did it take to get from Washington, D.C. to Sacramento, California back in those days?
I love this one, right? It took 6 months. Right. It took 6 months to get from D.C. to you know, San Francisco, you know, in the 1840s. And this is, why is this relevant? People might ask. Well, it's hugely relevant because if you think about how we think about governance of schools, if you think about how you're going to organize talent who staff those schools, if it is incredibly hard to move people or information, then you need strategies which are very directly local. It only makes sense to have somebody right there down the street managing your school, and that's where your teachers have got to come from. You know, we live in a slightly different era. We can move information around the world in a half a second. you can get from, you know, New York to Singapore in about 18 hours. You can manage people via Skype or a conference call, wherever the heck they happen to be. So it's interesting to me that we still have this pathological attachment to kind of geographic localism, even in an era when, you know, all kinds of nonprofits and for-profits run operations that are in 35 states and 45 countries.
Well, I love this line. You say, quote, common schoolers, progressives, and rafts of contemporary reformers view the American passion for checks and balances, its suspicions of federal government, and its attachment to localism as plagues to be combated or at best tolerated. You're saying reformers of all eras get driven crazy by the fact that they have to work through states and local districts and fragmentation. They can't easily make changes.
No, that's, you know, I mean, right? The hallmark of reformers in any era, you know, the true believer reformers of the moment or those of a century ago, is they know exactly what America needs. And anybody who has any sense agrees with them. And anybody who doesn't agree with them is either blind or, you know, on the side, on the wrong side of the issue.
And, or self-interested.
Or self-interested. Right. And therefore, any kind of, any checks and balances, any governmental elements that get in their way of pushing through the right thing are clearly horrible, terrible things.
So even back 100 years ago then, when these, you know, a lot of what the structures we know today were being developed, there were reformers who didn't basically like local control.
Well, that's right. I mean, if you think about, like, school board elections today are in most cases off cycle, means they don't happen the same day as congressional or presidential, you know, elections. They're nonpartisan. These things were all done by the progressives because they wanted to take politics out of school governance. They said, ha, if we put them in the spring, if we make them nonpartisan, all those people who vote based on party labels or who only show up to vote for Congress, we'll get them out of the mix. And they succeeded. Now, it didn't depoliticize, but it meant that the most people who showed up were those who had skin in the game, mostly employees of the school district, disproportionately, who could then elect who their bosses were going to be. But I mean, this is, you know, this is the mindset of progressives. So we often hear this today that, you know, anything that slows up the ability of, you know, the Obama administration to drive its preferred approaches to school improvement grants or its preferences with regard to teacher evaluation are, you know, just frustrating, or the Common Core,
right,
are frustrating hurdles. And, you know, I think there's a hubris about that, which is, you know, not uncommon among would-be reformers.
Right. If only those states and districts would do what we were telling them to do, then we wouldn't have these problems with implementation.
And you hear this talk about consensus. Thomas Friedman, right, famously talked about, you know, oh, I'm so envious of China. They can solve problems with the snap of the premier's fingers. And, you know, you hear that kind of envy among reformers, that what we need is consensus. We need buy-in from everybody because we know what we need to do, and just how do we convince everybody to agree?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, part of the, you know, Mitch McConnell recently, you know, just recently, the federal government finally reached a compromise on the debt ceiling agreement that we were all following so avidly all through the summer. And, you know, Mitch McConnell said in his speech in the Well of the Senate, you know, people are talking about how this was a failure of government. It's not. This is how our government's supposed to work.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's interesting that so many people who want to make education better are profoundly uncomfortable with the design of the American system of government.
Interesting. I found this interesting. You go into a little bit about where age-based grading came from, right? There was a time when, you know, certainly one-room schoolhouses, kids of all ages were thrown in there together. Schools got bigger, more kids coming to school. And at some point, somebody decided it was a good idea to have all the seven-year-olds together.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You know, and it's funny because it doesn't make innate sense, right? 30 years ago, Ted Sizer was talking about how it made sense to group kids according to level of accomplishment so that you can instruct them. School of One in New York City today takes an intuition. Let's organize kids by learning by where they are learning. But the center of gravity in American schooling is let's just organize kids by how old they happen to be. And, you know, where that came from, famously, Horace Mann, when he was chair of the Massachusetts Board of Ed, so much in American ed, you can trace to Horace Mann, took a trip to Europe back in the 1840s.
It wasn't Finland he went to, was it?
You know, no. This was back when people had a whole different set of idols. They were excitedly, but you could think of him as an earlier era Michael Barber.
Yeah,
going and getting very excited about something he saw here or there, and he went to Germany. And he saw that the German classrooms were very neat and orderly. He particularly liked the way the kids were the same size, you know, same general, you know. And he thought this was wonderful. And it just looked so professional. So he came back to Massachusetts and started to institute a policy of grade level organization of schools, age level grades. Now, what's funny about why the Germans did it was under Napoleon, France had kicked Germany's butt in the earlier part of the 19th century. And to combat the lethargy and kind of the moroseness of the population, the Prussian government was doing all kinds of things to try to reassure people that they were going to get the house in order and pick up their game. One of the things they did was they thought the way Napoleon had his troops in these very orderly, crisp platoons was what was impressive, and they decided that they would go ahead and model their schools on the way that Napoleon organized the French army.
Wait, so we organize our schools based on an idea that stemmed from Napoleon?
In fact, right. We organize our schools because we were impressed by the way the Germans tried to reassure their depressed population after losing to Napoleon's troops. And this, of course, becomes then the default model, say, for No Child Left Behind, because NCLB, given its grade level accountability framework, says that if you try to organize grades 3 to 8 by something other than age, you are going to run into all kinds of grief as far as state accountability systems.
Unbelievable.
So what's amazing about this is, you know, political scientists, sociologists call this path dependency, the way that one development or decision kind of locks you into others. And it's really, and I think that's what, you know, so many of these emotional debates, say, around teacher tenure was made perfect sense. You know, when New York State used to routinely fire teachers because they didn't conform to the state's height and weight chart. Like me, I'm a chunky guy. I would have been canned. In that era, if you're a teacher, fighting for tenure seems to make all the sense in the world because you didn't have other civil service protections. But what happens is when the rules of the game change, when you start to get employment protections, when you change civil service rules, we don't then go back and say, well, let's take a look at this tenure thing all over again. What happens is once these things are in place, they tend to stick around for generation after generation.
On path dependency, you have some good analogies in there. So, for example, the healthcare system in the United States.
Right. I mean, what people are only glancingly aware of is that, you know, the way we wound up with this employer-based healthcare system was really very much a fruit of World War II. During World War II, we had wage and price controls put in place, and one of the few ways employers were able to reward their employees with benefits was by offering expansive healthcare. So, if you remember, during World War II, we had enormously low unemployment, because everybody was either in the armed forces or being sucked up to work in places like Pontiac and Flint and Detroit. And so these big industrial firms got into the habit of offering pretty expansive healthcare benefits. And after World War II, this became part of, with all this tax-favored status, this became part of the routine package that was offered by the late 1960s. So we wind up with a system which made sense given what we were trying to do as far as fiscal policy during World War II, which wound up expanding during the explosion of growth in the late 40s, 1950s, and wound up getting cemented in place by big collective bargaining agreements. But it turns out that when you then try to reform the system, as Clinton in 1994, 1993, or the Healthcare Reform Act debates a couple of years ago, people have now become deeply invested in their employer-provided coverage. And even though neither liberals nor conservatives think it's the smart or useful way to offer healthcare, you're now in a situation where this is what you're threatening to take away from people.
Amazing. One more historical chapter I want to talk about, and that was around Catholic schools. It sounded like it. You know, we take for granted that there was this enormous system of Catholic schooling built between about 1900 and 1950. You seem to imply that at one point this wasn't inevitable, that this was built for a reason.
Oh yeah. You know, I mean, the Catholic schools were respond, right? Our public school, people forget why we built out the public schools that we did. You know, we get very excited about the common school movement. The common school movement was because we had all of these Catholics coming from Ireland, from Southern and Eastern Europe, who scared the bejesus out of the Anglos who were here first. And the Anglos are really worried that these people weren't going to be the right kinds of citizens. And so the primary motivation behind building out the common schools was to create boxes where we could get all these Catholic kids away from their parents for a bunch of time and have them read the King James Bible. Now, if you're a Catholic, after a certain point, this starts to feel, as it should, offensive. So what you saw was a substantial push to build out parochial school systems. Famous battles in New York State in the early in the first half of the 19th century, nationally, you know, by the middle of the 19th century, in which Catholics were trying to ensure that their children would have schools to attend where they were not constantly told that Catholicism was bad and constantly urged to read the King James Bible. You know, in fact, as late as the early 1900s, in the state of Oregon, the Ku Klux Klan headed up an effort to outlaw parochial schools, require all children to attend state-run schools for the age of 16. They passed a law. It was overturned by the U.S. Supreme Court in the case Pierce v. Society of Sisters. So the notion that, you know, Catholic schooling has always been kind of a comfortable or familiar part of the U.S. educational fabric is just not so. It was something that Catholics, you know, fought aggressively. Fought aggressively to introduce and to protect. And, you know, the Catholic schools had their heyday through the 60s or 70s. And since that era, we've seen kind of a steady decline for a variety of reasons, especially in the urban core.
And it's interesting. It wasn't that public school supporters were against Catholic schools because they were teaching religion. The public schools were teaching religion, too. It was just which religion.
Yeah, exactly right.
Yeah. Fascinating. Okay, we're talking with Rick Hess, the author of The Same Thing Over and Over, How School Reformers Get Stuck in Yesterday's Ideas. We'll be back after a break.
For in-depth features, cutting-edge research, and up-to-the-minute commentary on education policy, check out educationnext.org. There you'll find blog entries, new articles published weekly, plus videos, podcasts, and more. That's educationnext.org.
Back with Rick Hess. Rick, it's nice having you in the studio. We've done some of these over Skype, and it's so fun to have our guests here live.
You're so good at this, Mike. Whew. You've just got like that mellifluous voice. It's a whole thing.
Thanks, baby. Tell those folks over at NPR. Maybe I can get a gig over there sometime. All right, well, let's spend the rest of our time talking about the implications of all of this, of the history and going forward. You seem to be very skeptical about the idea that science is finally going to provide the key areas, that you know, there really is a blossoming of education research right now, a lot of empirical studies, random assignment studies, a lot of focus on what works. And a lot of people think, look, if we can just get the data and if we can do these solid studies, we'll make much better decisions. You're skeptical. Why?
Very skeptical. Because we've been here, for one thing, is... You know, so much of what we care most about here, I don't think lends itself to what we classically think of as the scientific method. You know, if you know, when we talk about healthcare as a model, for instance, if you're trying to find out whether a particular pill is going to address a health condition, a headache, you do your double-blind sample, you give this particular pill to these particular individuals under controlled circumstances, and you see whether or not there seems to be a statistically valid result. That's pretty straightforward. On the other hand, that approach really works poorly when you're dealing with, say, AIDS prevention in Africa or childhood obesity. Because, frankly, if you start to distribute clean needles or you build a playground in a disadvantaged community, it's not clear exactly what the intervention is. It depends how people use it, when they use it, whether. So there are all these interaction effects which don't lend themselves to clean. Well, most of education is like that. If we're talking about particular reading programs, if we're talking about a particular way to teach a math objective, then that intervention strategy, discrete intervention, discrete client, controlled circumstances holds. And we can really use research to learn a lot about particular elements. But when we're talking about merit pay, teacher evaluation, school choice, there's a reason that the National Institutes of Health don't weigh in on how we pay doctors or how we evaluate nurses, because it doesn't lend itself to this kind of research. So one is, I just think so much of what we want research to answer, do school improvement grants work? Are charter schools good? are just not the kinds of questions where science can really tell us much that's meaningful. But more fundamentally, we've been here before. I mean, none of this should be new. In 1899, one of my favorite quotes in the book is, the head of the U.S. Patent Office, this is before 1900, wondered about what we were going to do with the Patent Office because he said everything that can be invented has already been invented. Right. 4 years rather, 4 years later, the Wright brothers do the first plane. This is before microwaves. This is before Tang, for heaven's sake. I mean, nothing had been invented. But he's like worried that we've run out of things to actually issue patents for. In 1917, in the 1910s, there was a massive explosion of research around IQ, around measuring intelligence, around testing. In fact, 1917, almost a century ago, Elwood Cubberley, the dude who Stanford's education school is named for, you know, big building is named for, said, look, we have entered into a new era of education where with scientific precision, we can measure what works. And now, 90 years later, we're all bad-mouthing the fact that we've never actually had tests or measured. Well, 3-4 generations ago, people thought they had these tests and they thought they measured. So it's not that nobody's ever tried this. Mm-hmm. It's that it has persistently proven a hell of a lot harder than we'd like it to be, I think, for these reasons that I mentioned a moment ago.
And a lot of the questions that we care about will never be answered by research because they're about values. They're about your vision of the good life, about what kind of society we want to have. So this question of should all kids go to college or should kids be trained to go into the workforce? I mean, you might think about ways to try to rigorously study which kinds of kids do better in which circumstances. But at the end of the day, it's about, well, you know, do you think if a family says, hey, I won't, you know, I'm happy with my kid going to work at a factory and having, you know, a cottage on the lake on the weekends and hanging out with his friends, that's what I want for him. You know, do the elites have a right to overrule that and say, no, we want you to be part of this learned society?
Absolutely. How much should testing matter? Should teaching be a profession? At the end of the day, these are as much about how we think about the world and how we think the world works as they are about anything that can be easily measured.
Now, you call today's reformers the new progressives. Was that your term, or is that now an official academic term floating out there?
No, I think I actually left it. I think I credit it to Larry Cuban,
okay,
who did this in a contribution to my, I guess, 2006 educational entrepreneurship book.
Yeah,
when he was turning a skeptical eye on new leaders from new schools and.
Yeah. No, I like it. I think it's a good term. So you say, but you attack the new progressives for not being bold enough with their thinking or their policy proposals. That mm-hmm. they you know, talk about these huge problems we're facing, and then the things that they propose are just tiny little minute changes in one direction or the other.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what is it that they're not doing right? In which ways are they not thinking boldly enough?
They're not. Frankly, I mean, that's again partly what I think moved me to write this book. Is they are taking so much of where we are in American schooling as a given. So they talk about trying to get better teachers. Same teaching job. We're not going to change the rhythms of the job in any meaningful way, but we're going to try to get 3.4 million people who are better at it. We're going to get better schools. We're going to leave the schools intact. Maybe we're going to pipe in a little bit of online instruction, but leave the rest of it intact. But more or less, what we're working about is getting better schools. School districts, we're going to move from school boards to mayors, but we're not going to question whether or not districts are a smart way to organize delivery of instruction in the 21st century. This strikes me as more or less they have accepted all of the assumptions and definitions of people who are not reformers. So if merit pay is we're going to leave most of the teacher pay schedule intact, but we're going to give you, you know, $5,000 if your test scores pump up enough. Well, I'm not for that, and I'm not against that. That just strikes me as a tedious and stupid way to talk about using pay as reform. If teacher evaluation is we're going to leave the job the same as it is, but we're just going to measure 50% of your evaluation will be how much your kid's test scores went up, and 35% will be structured evaluation. The reason the job looks the way it did was because when Horace Mann was trying to find enough warm bodies to run these boxes where they could brainwash Catholic kids, women were cheap labor. And they didn't think they needed to do much. They just needed to stand in front of a room and read the King James Bible with 60 kids. So that's what we did. I'm not sure that if our goal is to educate all kids to a high level, to a high level, that those kinds of teachers are what makes sense. So what does that mean? It means we need to think differently about the job. How do you use the talent in the schools? What are the different kinds of job descriptions that exist? How are these different job descriptions paid differently? Mm-hmm. And you don't hear reformers really talking about very much of this because they are so invested in trying to make the old teachers and the old schools better that they don't have much time to think about how would you reimagine teaching and schooling for the problems we're solving today.
So is the answer then to have some central planners, some think tankers like us come together and design this school of the future that rethinks everything and then to plop it out there across the country?
Yeah, no, not so much. Right. I mean, and this is... You know, and again, you know, you flagged before, you know, kind of my notion that people are uncomfortable with checks and balances. And one of the things I say is that, you know, so many of the Finlandophiles out there in their enthusiasm for having us imitate a country that's, you know, 1/60th our size with remarkably less heterogeneity and, you know, that's a less dynamic society, really... You know, what Finland, if they are accurately depicting Finland, and I often have qualms, but if, let's just stipulate they're accurately depicting it, what works in that context, a tiny nation with a relatively homogenous population in an isolated corner of the world, may or may not be, and I think it is not, well suited to tackling, to tapping the genius of America.
It might work in Vermont.
But the genius of America has always been that we have embraced and leveraged our dynamism, our heterogeneity, our uncertainty, our federal structure in ways that have created opportunities to problem solve. And I think that's what's called for here, that rather than have the, you know, a presidential administration try to push everybody to embrace the right model of teacher evaluation or the right way to turn around schools, that what we really need to do is foster and energize people who are thinking differently about what are the ways in which we are going to foster excellence. And I think there's probably all different kinds of ways to do it for different kinds of kids, taking advantage of the different talent that exists in a Boston versus a rural Tennessee versus a San Francisco, and taking advantage of new technologies. And how do you start to design schools and providers of talent and suppliers of online instruction and weave them together into ways that are going to, you know, really serve kids exquisitely in the 21st century.
And so you basically talk about a diversity of educational institutions. Is this basically, in the end, just a call for school choice?
No. You know, because school choice, as I've written about, you know, before, the problem with school choice is that it opens a door. You know, I'm in favor of school vouchers. I'm in favor of tuition tax credits and charter schools, other things equal. Because they start to create opportunities for families to make a few more choices. But that's not very interesting to me. That's just the demand side of the old supply-demand curve. If you think back to your intro college econ, all of the action on that curve really happens on the supply side. And what I'm interested in is not just having more better schools, even though that'd be nice, and choice doesn't even do that by itself. But I'm interested in people saying, look, if kids aren't being well-served when it comes to music education, the answer is not to open a whole new school and do a little better music education. The answer is, can people figure out a way to deliver music instruction that's higher quality, more accessible, and richer? If people don't like the foreign language options, question is, how do we deliver high quality, you know, accessible foreign language? So I think the problem with school choice and the hold that it's had on the reform community, much like with accountability, is that it is a tool. It's a useful step forward. It's a helpful way to think about these things. But rather than see it as one brick on a pathway towards reimagining schools, much like with teacher evaluation today, too many reformers have kind of gotten caught up in this, and that if we get this done, somehow schools are going to work.
Excellent. Rick Hess, the author of The Same Thing Over and Over, How School Reformers Get Stuck in Yesterday's Ideas. Rick, what are you working on next?
The book for next year is delivered to Harvard in next summer. It's called Cage Busting Leadership. It's if you are working within these systems as a superintendent or a member of their staff or principal, how do you look at all the stuff that you've inherited, all these rules and regs and the contracts and the culture, and how do you kind of embrace the opportunity to really solve problems in fundamentally smarter and better ways?
Sounds like a blockbuster. Rick, thanks for joining us. You've been listening to the Education Next Book Club. Executive producer of the Education Next Book Club is Marcy Kansterum. Audio engineer is Joe Portnoy. And I'm your host, Mike Petrilli, for the Education Next Book Club.